Welcome to another edition of Oncology Today, this program focused on the management of immune thrombocytopenia. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Hani Alsamkari from Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding video program featuring Dr. Alsamkari's slide presentation. To begin, we reviewed a few cases from his practice, but before that, I shared with Dr. Alsamkari an interesting personal story that connects me to a legendary figure in the history of ITP. I did want to tell you one thing I thought you might find interesting, which is that when I did my internship and residency in internal medicine 150 years ago, the head of the Department of Medicine, who did this morning report every day that we would go to, was a person by the name of Bill Harrington at the University of Miami.
Yep, Bill Harrington. Can you believe? He's one of the godfathers of ITP, the Harrington-Hollingsworth experiments.
Yeah, no, I know. Yep. I can remember him sort of gazing out the window during morning. He was a real thinker, you know.
I know, it's crazy. That's such a fun story. You know, most people don't know that he had a grand mal seizure shortly after infusing himself with the ITP patient's blood.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and he was really sick for a while. He didn't infuse himself with plasma. He infused himself with the whole blood. Yeah.
Wow.
I did not know that. Interesting way of doing things back then. So we're going to go through a couple of cases in this presentation to kind of frame the information. So case one is a 66-year-old woman with a past medical history of hypertension and Sjogren's syndrome who presents to the ED with diffuse petechiae of the upper and lower extremities. She awoke this morning to the taste of iron in her mouth and saw large blood blisters on her oral mucosae. On initial labs, her platelet count is 4. The remainder of her CBC is unremarkable. She endorses recovering from a case of bronchitis about 3 weeks ago. She states that she felt relatively normal about a week ago, but then has had worsening fatigue over the past 3 days. The patient is admitted for treatment of newly diagnosed ITP. When told she is to receive treatment including corticosteroids, she becomes anxious. As she states, a prior 3-day methylprednisolone pulse given for a complication of her Sjogren's gave her severe anxiety and insomnia while she was getting the pulse. Which of the following is the next best step in the management of this patient? So this is a clinical scenario that comes up quite frequently when a patient presents with newly diagnosed ITP. How do we treat the patient? Do we give corticosteroids? If we give corticosteroids, do we give prednisone or dexamethasone? Do we give IVIG? Do we give both? These questions come up all the time. And this patient case is illustrative in how we can approach this. So, you know, in that initial case, right, it's very reasonable to give corticosteroids, not dexamethasone, but prednisone, or one could opt for IVIG. All right, case two, a 30-year-old man with chronic ITP presents for follow-up. He is not currently receiving therapy, though received dexamethasone treatment 18 months ago when he was diagnosed. He denies bleeding or constitutional symptoms at this time. His platelet count today is 29,000. The remainder of his CBC is unremarkable. He is not on antithrombotic therapy and lives a sedentary lifestyle, working an office job. He does express anxiety about his platelet count as it was 45,000. At his prior visit 3 months ago, he says it was 50% higher. How would you manage him? Would we give him more dexamethasone? Would we start him on a second-line therapy like a thrombopoietin receptor agonist, remiplistim, or we even refer him for a splenectomy? Or would we just observe him and reassure? So this is a great, you know, example of a case where the patient is doing just fine. He's not on treatment. We could just observe this patient. We can reassure him about the platelet count fluctuations that happen very commonly in ITP. He's not bleeding. Yeah, his platelet count's 29,000. It's less than 30,000, but you know, he's a young person. He has no substantial comorbidities. He would be just fine with observation. And I just have this slide again to remind us that we don't want the treatment to be worse than the disease. So all of those treatments are associated with some potential side effects, some with financial toxicity, some with, you know, psychosocial issues. So we don't want to worsen any of that if we don't have to. So the patient does well with reassurance for the next 2 years at platelet counts ranging between 25 and 50,000 without therapy. Now he calls the office because he noted some new, if minor, petechiae in his legs, got over a bad head cold 2 weeks ago, found to have a platelet count of 15,000, which the following would we do now. All right, so we could start him on prednisone and admit him, or we could consider, again, a host of second-line therapies. So after discussion of the patient's treatment options, he prefers an oral TPO-RA. His insurance prefers L-trombopag, and oftentimes, right, the payer is the one that makes the decision in the United States, not necessarily the case in other countries, but that's often the case. He's prescribed L-trombopag. He agrees to adhere to the necessary dietary restrictions on L-trombopag. He promptly recovers his platelet count and maintains it at goal 100 to 200,000 range. LFT monitoring shows no abnormalities. He does well on oral L-trombopag for many years. So case three, a 65-year-old woman with chronic ITP presents for follow-up. Her platelet count today is 11,000. She has scattered petechiae on her legs. She's had ITP for over a decade, and during that time has received multiple courses of steroids and IVIG. She has received two TPO-RAs. Previously, she's received rituximab. She hasn't had a splenectomy yet, but she is extremely resistant to this option. She does not want surgery. She does not want her spleen to be removed. She still responds to steroids and IVIG, but the duration to both is short-lived. So what is the next step? What's the next step you would use to manage this patient? Would you begin chronic prednisone to try to keep her platelet count greater than 30,000? Give IVIG, say, you know, reassure her, her bleeding is mild, refer her for a splenectomy, even though that she's not interested in that, or refer her for a clinical trial of an investigational agent. I hope you would think to do the last, right? We don't want to put patients on chronic steroids. IVIG chronically is really a end of the line treatment option when there's really no other option. We can think about that, but that's obviously, difficult for the patient and problematic and costly. We can't just send a patient who's bleeding home and reassure her and observe. That's not acceptable. The bleeding is mild now, but it might not be mild next week. The patient doesn't want a splenectomy. So, and this is, again, not all that uncommon. Another variant of this case could be a patient who's already had the splenectomy and relapsed. And this patient probably would have a less than 50% chance of responding to splenectomy based on the new modern data that I showed you.
So I want to kind of get into some of the things you see in second opinion when you see cases and how you see people getting managed in the community. But first, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the I and ITP, and I'm curious what your vision is for the autoimmune issues that come up in CLL, including thrombocytopenia, and how you contrast that to a typical, quote, ITP.
Yeah, that's a great question. I have very little doubt in my mind that ITP is really multiple different diseases that have each, you know, a different dominant aspect of their pathophysiology, and that we, in our very simplistic evaluation of a CBC, are seeing low platelets and saying, this person has ITP. You know, we recognize, I'll give you another example. We recognize that patients with certain inborn errors of immunity, patients who have congenital immunodeficiencies, those patients will present with, they can present with bad ITP just like anybody else can develop idiopathic ITP, or a patient with CLL can develop ITP as secondary. You know, it's quite often the case that using T-cell directed therapies is what gets those patients into a remission. Using things off-label like mycophenolate mofetil or, you know, azathioprine, for example. You know, it's these details that I hope my vision is I hope we are able to really understand more about each individual patient over the next two decades, so that we're not just picking drugs based on their toxicity profiles and, you know, how they're the mode of administration and things like this, but rather are picking treatments based on the patient's underlying, you know, sort of autoimmune phenotype, you know, that's really happening. CLL is a great example. I mean, it's a malignant clone induced immune dysregulation, which is quite different than, say, a patient that has quote unquote idiopathic or primary ITP, and that immune modulation may be much more effective in a CLL patient than could be in just a garden variety ITP, primary ITP, where they respond much better to a thrombopoietin receptor agonist. You know, the reasons for that at the, you know, really nitty gritty pathophysiologic level, we don't know, but it's something that we hope to understand more about.
So, because I know one of the issues that comes up in CLL, and I'm not sure if it comes up anywhere else, but is the issue of whether to use, you know, typical sort of ITP type approaches, corticosteroids or rituximab, or to try to treat the underlying disease, not just with ibrutinib, but you could use a venetoclax, you know, it's theoretically. So, but, and I guess in other situations, you don't really know the etiology, but you had your patient with Sjögren's, for example, but I don't know if there's really a treatment for that. So, for example, with CLL, just again, I'm curious, how do you determine whether or not to treat the disease or the thrombocytopenia or anemia?
If the patient needs treatment for their CLL for malignancy reasons, you know, reasons related to we need to clear out their marrow, they have bulky adenopathy, what have you, then I say definitely treat the CLL. If the person's CLL is just kind of in the background and it's there and they develop ITP, then I specifically will treat the ITP with typical ITP-directed therapies. You know, we will use corticosteroids, we'll use, you know, rituximab, obviously, which will also treat the CLL. But that's the general approach. If someone is in crisis from ITP, you can't wait for a CLL treatment to work on the CLL. You obviously need to give them IVIG or you need to give them corticosteroids to raise their platelet count out of, you know, the single digit range. But our current relatively undeveloped understanding of the differences in pathophysiology between patients means that we use the same drugs to treat patients with, you know, CLL who have ITP and we don't need to treat their CLL versus those patients who have ITP that's primary or not due to CLL.
So let's go back to some of the scenarios you talked about in your presentation. And I'm curious kind of what you see in second opinions. And, you know, you see people have been managed by other people, whether there are any sort of misperceptions. I'm not going to say mistakes, but when people do things that say you wouldn't do. So let's start out with the initial straightforward, you know, initial presentation of ITP. How do you think it through? And what are some of the, let's say, myths or misperceptions out there?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. Thank you for asking it. So, you know, when patients initially present with ITP, in my experience, the majority of them actually don't need treatment. This might sound kind of crazy, but it's really true in that ITP is a disease of platelet count less than 100,000 with no other cause. It's still, you know, we can test for platelet autoantibodies at various centers, and I don't want to get into all that, but, you know, we don't have a gold standard test. And ultimately, that's what it comes down to. And so, you know, there are way more patients out there walking around with platelet counts between 30 and 100,000 who have ITP than there are those that are showing up in the ED with, you know, a petechiae all over their legs. Obviously, those are the more dramatic ones and the ones we need to do something about right away. But most of the time when I have a patient diagnosed with ITP, you know, one of the main myths is, oh, my patient's platelet count is 45,000. I should treat them to try to maybe remit the ITP or something along those lines. And that's just not, you know, we have to think about the toxicities of therapies and corticosteroids don't cure patients with ITP. Neither does IVIG in general. So, you know, we need to be, in the newly diagnosed setting, we need to recognize who needs to be treated, who doesn't. Those patients who have bleeding need to be treated irrespective of their platelet count. And platelet count tends to correlate less with bleeding in older adults than it does in everyone else. And so I don't care if somebody's platelet count is 50,000. If they have bleeding manifestations and they're, you know, 82 years old, you need to treat that person because, you know, there's something that is putting them at risk, whether it's connective tissue based or, you know, some medication they're on that's impacting their platelet function or something that makes that patient in need of treatment. I would say the only other thing in the first line in terms of like maybe the top three things to address in each line from my experience, you know, I talk about this, the use of IVIG, which I tend to see a lot of patients who, you know, after they're sort of referred, after they've had their first line therapy, and they tend to get a lot of steroids plus IVIG every time they have an exacerbation, really don't need to do that. If somebody's platelet count is, you know, it doesn't matter if it's one or two or three, if they're not having any sort of significant bleeding and they have no history of significant bleeding, I'm talking about GI bleeding, brain bleeding, you know, they don't have other clear risk factors for bleeding, you don't need to give them IVIG. You know, giving them IVIG is, it's not pleasant for the patient in many circumstances, and it's costly, and we have IVIG shortages every now and again. Steroids will do for them.
So it's interesting that a lot of these patients, sort of the ITP goes away. It's a temporary phenomenon. Any thoughts about why? Do you think these are post-infectious or what's going on?
Yeah, excellent question. It goes down to the underlying pathophysiology piece that we don't fully understand. But at the same time, we do know that for adults, approximately 20 to 30% of those patients will not progress to chronic disease, which is one of the main reasons why we don't splenectomize patients in the first year. We really advise against it, except in those extraordinarily rare emergency situations. We are calling a lot of things ITP. This is the issue, right? So if somebody, you mentioned post-infectious, it's very common for viruses, herpes viruses, respiratory viruses. Viruses can cause a bone marrow suppression. They can cause a shorter term drop in the platelet count. Very common. We actually published some data showing that, you know, COVID vaccination can cause platelet autoantibody titers to rise temporarily, and then they come down. So, you know, it's really our simplistic understanding. Hopefully in the future, we'll be able to say this person just has infectious ITP, it will go away, or this person has a temporary ITP that will go away, and modify our treatment accordingly, and recognize those patients who are not like that. But yes, it's because we bucket everything into this one diagnosis.
Can you talk a little bit about second line therapy, and again, some of the mistakes or myths you see in the community?
Yeah. Yeah. So with second line therapy, I think the most common thing I see in patients referred to me for second opinion or patients who self-refer is that the failure is declared before complete uptitration of the agent. So it's very common that a patient doesn't respond to 3 micrograms per kilogram of remiflustim, or they don't respond to 4. You know, the label says start at 1 microgram per kilogram and increase by 1 microgram per kilogram each week, which is, I mean, that takes 2.5 months to get to the max dose of 10 micrograms per kilogram. That's a long duration of time for somebody to be profoundly thrombocytopenic. If they're very thrombocytopenic, it makes everybody uncomfortable. It's painfully slow. The phase 3 studies of remiflustim and ITP actually started with 3 microgram per kilogram dosing. That's what I start with. I don't start with 1. I start with 3. And I don't hesitate to titrate by more than 1 if I feel that the situation calls for it. And there's been some data that's published on this, not a whole heck of a lot, but some that's published on this. You know, thrombocytosis is something you want to avoid because it certainly very likely does increase thrombosis risk. We see from primate studies with TPO thrombopoietic agents that it increases thrombosis risk. But it's all about the time that the person is at that. You know, and if someone has thrombocytosis for a week or two, I mean, it's usually not the end of the world, and we really want to get them out of that low, a very low platelet count place. So people will declare failure because they don't have the patience kind of to follow that label. And I understand why they don't have the patience to follow that label, but just, you know, use some art of medicine and titrate faster. So that's I think one of the more common things that I see. Another common thing I see is a patient has been tried on 1 thrombopoietin receptor agonist and they failed that, so they don't try anymore. And there is now good data with all three of these drugs in terms of switching from one agent to another. And when you're switching for convenience, like if you're trying to get somebody off of an injectable to an oral, or you're switching because of an adverse event they had on one of the prior agents, the chance of response on the next agent is, you know, upwards of 70 to 80%. When you're switching for inadequate effectiveness of the prior agent, the chance of response on the second agent is 50 to 60%. That's still better than half, you know, better than a coin flip. And that's true with L-trombopag, avatrombopag, and remiplistin. Now, you might, sometimes if someone fails two, I will move to a different, you know, something like a fostamatinib or a rituximab or a clinical trial before going to trying a third. But we have tried third and seen response where the first two have failed. So it's, these drugs have some important differences at the cell signaling level and how they work. And just because somebody doesn't respond to one doesn't mean they're not going to respond to another. The third thing I would say is, we've really moved away from rituximab in the post-COVID era due to concerns for, you know, reduction in immunity without a likely improvement in long-term remission rate, right? So ianalumab could be, it's viewed in a different light because we want to potentially put people into remission with that drug. That's the idea there. With rituximab, we know we're not really putting anybody into a remission. And so, you know, given the concerns about the durability of that response and the impacts on, you know, immunity, we tend to shy away a little bit more from rituximab, a little bit more toward the other agents I mentioned, as they, you know, either have a reversible impact on immunity, as is fostamatinib, or they don't have an impact like the T4As.
Just out of curiosity, have other CD20 agents like obinutuzumab been looked at also?
No, so that's a good question. I do not believe obinutuzumab has been looked at. I think there have been some cases with ofatumumab, but this is not something that, it's a great question. It's not something that has been, you know, looked at in any sort of formal sense to see if other CD20 antibodies are as effective as rituximab or more effective.
Any other issues you see, any pearls that you bring up to your fellows about this that we haven't talked about?
Yes. So we talk a lot about bleeding and ITP, but I think it's important to remember the non-bleeding symptoms. And I had a little bit of the beginning of my presentation about this. You know, patients can have anxiety around their platelet count, which, you know, we don't want to necessarily treat with ITP-directed therapies, right? We want to treat that with counseling, and sometimes takes time, right? And people can just be very nervous, and they read horror stories on online and various things. But we connect them with, like, for example, the PDSA, Platelet Disorder Support Association, and there are, you know, patient advocacy groups that patients can meet other people with their disease and be reassured, and just to remind them that, you know, we have many at normal at baseline. We have many more platelets than we need for to prevent bleeding. And patients with ITP, their platelets are typically big and you know, more active than average platelets. So, you know, we look at the mean platelet volume, which is much increased in patients with ITP, such that a patient with ITP has a platelet count of 20,000 really has an effective platelet count of 30 to 40,000. And so that it's different than other causes of thrombocytopenia. I teach my fellows this. I instruct patients. I like to show them pictures of their blood smears, and I show them a normal platelet on someone else's smear, and I show them their huge platelets. That can really be illustrative to help people understand. It takes a minute, and the person's understanding of their disease is changed forever. So I think that's an important piece, an important a couple pearls. I would also tell people, don't forget about fatigue and constitutional symptoms with ITP. So fatigue is the second most common symptom reported in ITP outside of bleeding. And, you know, in the newly diagnosed setting, ITP is a systemic autoimmune disease. Just like other systemic autoimmune diseases, there is some aspect of that problematic immune response, cytokine release and such that's leading these patients to have fatigue. It's real. Some patients know their platelet count has dropped because they develop overwhelming fatigue much before they develop any bleeding symptoms. So I think this is something I just want to remind people of, and you're not going to know about it if you don't ask about it in most cases. And in rare cases, it can be an indication to treat the patient because the fatigue can be so debilitating. And when their platelet count comes up, that patient may notice dramatic improvements in their fatigue. So that's rare, but something to think about.
That is really interesting. Do you see other autoimmune issues, nephritis, et cetera?
Yeah, you mean in patients who have ITP?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, ITP or autoimmunity begets autoimmunity. So the most common other autoimmune problem we see is thyroiditis, is hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's. One of the things we do, again, this is not standard of care in ITP, but as a sort of a tertiary ITP referral center, we do a little bit more testing on our ITP patients. We do platelet autoantibody testing. We do various other autoantibodies. We look at ANA. We look at anti-thyroid peroxidase antibody. And it's all to understand a gestalt, because if somebody has a sort of autoimmune phenotype, it pushes us more towards saying this patient has ITP versus this patient doesn't. Maybe we need to do a bone marrow biopsy because they're 67 years old and maybe they have MDS, you know. So it's something, you know, that's something we think about. And so thyroid disease is very common in terms of a comorbid. Patients can also have type 1 diabetes. Certainly ITP can be secondary to systemic collagen vascular diseases like lupus and Sjogren's, as was the case in the first case that I presented. It's quite a bit more common. And one of the most common questions we get is, doc, why did this happen? Why did I get this? I don't want this. Why did I get this? And just thinking about my gestalt, about, I don't know, majority, 60, 70% of the time, the patient has either a personal history of autoimmunity or a family history of autoimmunity. And, you know, I'm able to help them understand that it's sort of bad luck in combination with genetics and probably some trigger like a viral infection that they may or may not have noticed.
I'm curious how many times a year you have a patient go for splenectomy, and what do you see under your hands when you use it? Does it work?
Yeah, rarely. I said before, I like spleens. They're useful. Patients with ITP have thrombosis risk at baseline. And when we take out their spleens, you know, it's just awful to have a mesenteric thrombosis in an ITP patient, especially a young ITP patient. It's not that uncommon. Nowadays, I really seriously think about or refer a patient for splenectomy maybe once or twice a year. It's very rare. And most of the time, they don't end up getting the splenectomy. It's just a discussion with the surgeon. And they end up enrolling on a clinical trial instead. Or we try a salvage therapy, you know, things like azathioprine and mycophenolate and, you know, some of these off-label immunosuppressives, which, you know, have a real response rate in patients. It's low, and these patients have seen all the other approved therapies, but, you know, most people will prefer to cycle through those things because we know, right, from the data up front, the modern splenectomy data, that, I mean, it's less than a 50% likelihood in a heavily pretreated patient. That's rough. It's tough to say, you know, this is a less than 50% chance of this working. It's a surgery. It has all these complication risks, including thrombosis, and the chances are more likely that you're just going to end up where you are now, except in slightly worse shape. So I think it's just become a lot less attractive to people. But it is, I want to emphasize, it is an acceptable treatment option. It is still occasionally done. And sometimes you have patients say, look, I'm done with all these meds. They get side effects from the meds. They don't want to take meds. They understand they don't have 100% chance of splenectomy working, but they want to take the chance. And again, that's part of the shared decision-making piece.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Al Samkari, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.